You're listening to the programme Saskia Unreserved on RIC Classic. I'm very happy to cross over to London now to speak to Dr. Sarah Price, lecturer and researcher with a special interest in understanding audiences for arts and cultural events. A very good afternoon, Dr. Price.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
There's an increased pressure for classical music organizations really across the world to grow and diversify their audiences. This is often done through populist concerts, often more informal and therefore more accessible. But it's also criticized as a sort of dumbing down. I was fascinated to hear about your research during our recent EBU plenary meeting in Brussels, and so glad that you accepted this invitation to be on the program, despite, I know, a very busy schedule. So my first question is, are enough organizations actually conducting research?
Most organisations here, my experience is really here in the UK, and most organisations collect an awful lot of data about their audiences. They have all of the kind of insights that come from things like ticket sales, and within radio and TV, the audience teams that research how people listen and why. I think what we're often lacking is there are certain kinds of research that have a lot of attention and other kinds that don't. So there's a lot of data, there's a lot of statistics. What I tend to do as an academic is try and bring in qualitative data. So talking to audiences and hearing in their own words what classical music means to them. And I think where we need to go in the future is far more of that kind of research.
Do they realize about the value?
Do audiences or organizations?
No, let's take both, actually.
Do organizations realize the value in research? Certainly. My experience is that they are all absolutely dying to know more about their audiences. I think, though, maybe it's worth differentiating slightly, because I think some of the issue is sometimes that the question of audiences and understanding them and reaching them seems to sit within marketing departments. And actually, I think what we need is a far more integrated approach where the kind of artistic and programming teams are equally invested in understanding audiences.
Yes. What about from the audience perspective? Well, we'll come back to that as well, but just very briefly,
yeah.
Because it's them whom you're actually speaking to.
Yeah.
Isn't it? To actually ascertain why do they go to the concerts? Why do they choose those specific concerts? So it's data which is terribly important as far as you said, programming is concerned. For example, if you're looking at an orchestra.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think audiences, I think a lot of people who are very invested in classical music are always so willing to take part in research and want to contribute. I think where the challenge often lies in doing research is that people experience a lot of survey fatigue. You know, anytime you go to any kind
yes.
of event or you buy something, you're immediately hit with surveys. And that can be really hard then to engage audiences in that kind of research. My experience is that most people are actually quite happy to sit down and talk about their opinions and their lives if you do that more talk-based research.
Mm. What are some of the other impediments and challenges of doing this research?
I think the biggest challenge is often just time and capacity. I often think as an academic, that's what I can bring is a bit more space to be able to do this. And often it's just something that certainly doing those kind of big interview studies or lots and lots of focus groups with lots of diverse voices, it's often something that's just not within the capacity of teams who are programming and kind of marketing every day.
Mm. Your PhD analyzed the risk and reward in attending classical music concerts, work that you actually conducted with the City of Birmingham. Can you briefly outline your results and if in the last 7 years you've seen changes in approach?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So, so in my PhD, I looked at audiences who go to very core traditional concerts and then audiences who go to pop, populist, whatever kind of word you want to use there, concerts, and talked to each of them about the value that they find in the concerts they go to and how they, within these two types of concerts, there's such a sense of hierarchy and, you know, one is legitimate and the other one's just, oh, just entertainment or just fluff and all those things. And actually, that's not how it's perceived by audiences at all. They're both seen as really valuable in their own right. But the reason why, as you said, I talked about risk and reward and kind of put that right up there in the title of the thesis is that audiences do perceive quite high levels of risk within classical music. It's such an unusual art form in a couple of different ways. One being that if you're going to an event, you're going to a concert, most of the time you are seeing multiple pieces. That's really different to cinema or theatre or even opera. And so you're having to, maybe there's one piece that you absolutely love.
Yes.
You're having to weigh that up against other pieces that you might not be so sure about. And then because the pieces are then so long, and if you're talking about instrumental music, they're quite abstract. Actually, if you aren't enjoying it or you feel a bit lost within that piece, it can be quite a difficult situation to just be sitting there listening, feeling like you can't leave and yet feeling quite uncomfortable and like you're not really enjoying or engaging with the music. So there's always that sense when audiences pick concerts of them doing that weighing up process. Is the thing that I love worth the risk of sitting through other things that I might not enjoy, or I just don't know whether or not I'll enjoy?
So how then does money play a role?
Money plays a big role in certainly in kind of programming and the or do you mean more in terms of audiences?
In audiences, if they're going to say, well, there are two pieces out of the four which I don't particularly like. The ticket is £10. I'll give it a go. Or it's £25 plus the tube plus a drink, you know, in the evening. And oh, it's raining as well, so I'm not going to bother.
Absolutely, no, you've hit the nail on the head there. But I think sometimes we get a bit too, we focus a bit too much on money as the kind of source of the risk. But actually, even for, I mean, I'm sure probably we've all had that experience of being involved in putting on a free event, and you think, oh, it's free, so everyone will come, and
yes,
then not everyone comes. And I think actually people's time and energy is maybe even more of a factor than the price in terms of whether or not they think it's worth going to and worth taking that risk. Price can be, I guess, maybe more of a tipping point. If people are already a bit not sure, then that might be the thing that tips them into thinking, actually, it's not worth it.
If time plays a factor, do you think that this might be the beginning of shorter concerts rather than those that go on and on? I remember being horrified when Grigory Sokolov was here, and he played, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 encores. And I was mesmerized. But I did see after the second or third, you know, the audience by the end of the last one, we were maybe just a handful, you know, maybe 10 people left in the auditorium. Everybody else had got out, but he was happy to carry on playing. Do you think that time is a factor which is important for concert organizers to bear in mind?
Absolutely, I do. And I really hope that we're moving into a period of just greater variety in the length of concerts. I don't necessarily believe that every concert should start at around 7:30 and be about 2 hours long. I think that's a format that works for some things, but actually those shorter concerts, I personally love a short concert. I find, you know, go in, maybe there's an overture and a symphony, and then you leave and you go and have dinner or you go and have drinks. I find that just perfect, just the right amount of attention that I've got. And I think it's something that we should be experimenting with more.
Mm. Do you believe that the gap between academic and commercial research is lessening?
I absolutely do. Yeah, I wrote an article that came out, I think it's about 9 years ago now, that was basically me just having a big rant about how difficult it was to get academic and commercial research to kind of speak to each other, and the different approaches, the different ways of presenting information that just meant each side just didn't really engage with or even kind of respect the research that was happening in the other one.
Yes.
I think certainly in the UK that has really, really changed with we've got quite a lot of kind of policy incentives for academics and professionals to do more work together, and I think that has lent itself to a much more collaborative approach, but also a much more a kind of smoothing over of that gap of that the differences between the two. I still think there's more we can do, and I think as academics we should always be thinking about how we can make sure our research has actual tangible benefits to the wider society.
I always think of academic researchers really paying respects to others in the way data is analyzed, and it's not really like that in a commercial approach, is it?
Absolutely. I think in that article, I talk about this idea of half-life of research, and that in commercial research, or, you know, I say commercial, but obviously a lot of this is kind of non-profit, but let's say sector research, that there's this sense of you do research to try and bring about change often. And so within a few years, that research is seen as old because things have changed, whereas academic research has this ideal of having found some kind of universal truth that therefore is true forever. And I think probably there's a balance in the middle that we need to strike, that recognizing that people like, you know, like Bourdieu, we go back to his theory constantly. He was writing in 1980 France, and think about how much the digital revolution has changed so much of our lives. So I think we probably need to find some middle ground within that.
When you did your PhD research, did you actually have access to the audiences of the Birmingham Orchestra?
Yes, I did. Yes, so I worked with them. We have this lovely theme in the UK called Collaborative Doctoral Awards, and it basically means that you are based, as a PhD student, you are both based within a university and within a kind of organisational business.
Yes.
So I worked with the CBSO to then recruit their audiences to take part in my research.
Mm. In broadcasting, no interviews are conducted. Well, I should say in the Cyprus broadcasting. We don't know who our audience is, why they listen or why they don't, and what would encourage them to tune in. How important is it to have this information, especially with regard to a competitive edge?
I think it's absolutely crucial. It's so important to understand audiences' needs. I think otherwise we do a lot of programming and decision-making in a vacuum. And that is not to say, I think there is always this thought that doing market research, doing audience research, therefore leads to kind of pandering to the audience and, you know, just doing whatever it is the audience wants. And I don't think that is usually what happens. I think that it's about understanding audiences' lives and the way in which the broadcaster or the organisation or whoever it is that is doing the research, how they fit into audiences' lives. I think sometimes we can get quite kind of blinkered in thinking about, you know, the broadcaster, the organisation, as almost like the centre of the universe. And I think... And start talking about things like our audiences. What do our audiences want? And it just takes one or two interviews, sitting down with someone and talking about their lives, to realise that we are just this little planet orbiting our audiences and in all the complexity of the lives that they have. And I think it's that shift in perspective and thinking, what value can we bring to our audiences' lives that research really enables you to take?
Mm. What happens when you know, for example, that contemporary, let's take the example of contemporary opera. Everybody in the broadcasting world, and I'll take my colleagues at EBU into the fold in this, as I was part of that research, I think it was 67% said that they had no clue who was actually listening to opera. And yet, when they decided about the programming of contemporary opera, they said, well, it has to go here and it has to go here because this is what people want to hear. And I thought, well, that's, quite strange. Let's put it that way.
Definitely. I think there's this kind of gap that we have in a lot of the classical music sector, actually the wider arts and cultural sector, around the imagined audience and the actual audience. And the reality is that actually there's lots of really subtle and subconscious clues that we pick up on around audiences. And are they listening? Are they engaged? Did we get good listening figures? Did we get good ticket sales for that particular thing? And all of this is kind of internalized and becomes this this quite instinctive way of programming. But I think it does need to sit alongside more systematic forms of research where you speak to audiences and have those preconceptions challenged. Or I think often when with programming especially, there are a certain kind of audience that you've got in your mind. And what I think something like interviews can do is just put another face there, another person that you might be thinking about as you're making those decisions.
Right. We spoke earlier about qualitative and quantitative research. What would you say constitutes a good sample for a broadcaster who has a million potential people ready to tune in? How many would you say would be a good sample size for a survey as opposed to sitting down with interviews? How would you correlate the two?
It's that is a huge question that a lot of scholars have tried to work out, and I must confess that I'm not a data scientist, and I don't necessarily, I'm not the expert on that. I would say that what you're always looking to do is reach a kind of representative sample. So when it came, if you think about something like focus groups, you will want to be doing focus groups that represent the different kinds of listeners that you have,
right?
And if you can kind of get to a point where you've reached all of the main kinds of listeners that you have, then that is probably the point at which you've kind of reached a representative sample. I realize that is quite a fluffy answer, but
I'm just wondering, how do we get to know who those focus groups are? So for example, would you say that this is somebody who loves classical music, somebody who loves opera? How would you differentiate?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways you could differentiate. You could think, depending on really your research question, so you could think about differentiating in terms of demographics. Do you want people who are, you know, younger, older, at different kind of points in their lives? Do you want things like students or retirees, you know, things like that? You can also look at different kinds of engagement. So, yeah, you could look at people who only listen to The Breakfast Show or only listen to, you know, opera or listen to a bit of everything. And then you could also think about things like kind of level of engagement. So new listeners versus people who have listened for a very long time, people who listen a lot during the day, or people who only dip in every now and again. So often with things like surveys, there's a bit of, with things like focus groups, there's a bit of preliminary work that needs to be done to map some of those audiences so that you can then go and do the qualitative work that that is representative of the wider audience.
And then for sort of longer interviews, I'd say probably they're hour-long interviews where you'll actually sit down and speak to somebody. Do you find that you've needed to put a carrot in front of somebody in order to say, please come and sit and talk to me? Or are people generally willing to be part of the research? And are they people whom you've spoken to prior, or have you just picked them up randomly and said, would you be part of this research?
Yeah, so I find people are very, very willing to take part in interviews. I actually, whenever I've done surveys, I've always really struggled to hit the kind of numbers I'm looking for. Whenever I've done interviews, it's always been fairly easy to recruit. I think people really like talking about arts and themselves and all of those things. I think there are a few factors within that, though. As I specialise in kind of audiences for live music, I will tend to recruit people, depending on the kind of study I'm doing and the kind of people I'm looking for, recruiting people at events and actually just approaching people and talking to them and seeing that you're a normal human being who is specifically going to be the one interviewing them often helps to kind of put them at ease. I do think being an academic gives me some advantage when it comes to recruiting, because there's a sense of contributing to maybe something wider with research. But it is, I think sometimes people, I teach a lot of students and teach them kind of research methods and get them to do their own projects. And I think sometimes they're often quite nervous about whether or not they'll be able to recruit people. And yeah, my instinct is always, if it's interviews, you'll probably be okay. People like to talk.
Can we discuss knowledge incompatibility and the even more hostile knowledge resistance?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, this comes back to this article I wrote in, I think it's 2015.
I thought it was very interesting. That's why I wanted to bring it up.
So this is a concept that was put forward in another paper that I cite there. Of sometimes academics will come up with ideas and theories and suggestions that are then brought to arts organisations, who then say, well, that's great, but we can't do anything about that, or that completely flies in the face of everything we know, so it can't possibly be true. It's interesting, because I think largely, I would like to think largely that is a thing of the past, because I think we used to have these really awful hierarchical models within academia where we used to talk about knowledge transfer, and we would, you know, we would do all this research and then we would go and take it to these poor people who don't know anything, and we would change their lives. And I think now we respect that there is a huge amount of expertise out in the sector. We are not the experts. People who are on the ground, you know, putting on events, working with audiences day to day, are the experts. And so doing that longer, more collaborative research process usually means by the time that you are finding, you know, you've got your findings, you're making suggestions, you're making them in the knowledge of what arts organisations might be able to do. You're not suggesting things that are completely wildly inappropriate for their organisations.
Why do you think it is that people, when confronted with scientific evidence which challenges their pre-existing beliefs, try to ignore it or reason it away, as Goldacre in 2010 describes it in Bad Science, Challenging Behavior.
I think there's a lot of, I think a lot of this is just about being human, and that we really struggle to quickly change our opinions on things. And actually, we really criticize people who do. You always get in the news, you know, oh, this politician has done a U-turn on this thing. And we should be celebrating that. We should be saying, oh, they've changed their mind. And hopefully if that's come from better evidence, then that should be a good thing. So I think we have these cognitive biases towards maintaining the views that we already have, and it takes a huge amount of evidence communicated in the right way for people to start to change their mind on those issues. But it is, that's the principle of science, really, is that, you know, you take all of the information you have to date, you come up with a conclusion. If something else comes along and challenges it, then we should all be ready to engage with that new idea and see whether or not that might hold a better way of understanding or something close to truth.
I'm also curious about ticket booking habits. Do you think that it's very important for each organization to have their own in-house ticketing? So do people tend to support one organization, for example, for a whole season? So they would go to the Scottish National Symphony, for example, and say, I'm going to buy a season ticket. Or do you find that things are a little tight and people prefer to go ticket, you know, concert by concert?
Yeah, I think there's maybe two parts to that question. I think it's often really beneficial for organizations to have their own box office. It does depend on whether they are resident at a single venue for a long period of time, or whether there's whether they're kind of dipping between lots of, or touring around lots of different venues. I think that the data that you can get from ticket sales is just so enormously valuable, and it's often really challenging if you're having to work with, if an organization is having to work with multiple box office teams, to be able to actually get that data in a really meaningful way. So I think there is a benefit whenever things like that are kept in-house. That being said, with audiences, it does seem like the subscription model is maybe not on its way out, but certainly in decline. And it feels like the younger generations that classical music organizations are always so keen to attract don't seem to have the same sense of loyalty. So whether that's loyalty to an organization or to Netflix or Amazon Prime, and you just switch between them whenever you want them, you know, that sense of loyalty doesn't seem to be sustaining. So I think what we're seeing is a lot more people buying, the odd ticket here and there to lots of different places.
I'm glad you brought up the younger audiences. They are always the target, probably because the older audiences are already there. But why do you think there is this sort of change happening, and that they're very careful, I would say, as to which concerts they're going to go to and what they're going to try out?
I love that you called it careful, because I think sometimes we, when audiences don't behave exactly the way we want them to, we can get quite dismissive of their behaviour. But you're right, it's care, and it's trying to really pick and choose the kinds of experiences that they want to have. As to why it's changing so much, I think there is a kind of societal shift that has been happening since the kind of since internet became so kind of widespread, and you know, the web 2.0 era, where where our screens are just really tempting all the time and kind of omnipresent in our lives. And so we have a lot of reasons to be at home, actually. We have a lot of entertainment that will come straight into our homes, and it needs to be a concert or any other kind of event needs to be good enough to warrant leaving the house.
Right.
And then on top of that, we have this whole, there's this kind of theory that comes out through media studies called the experience economy. And this whole thing of actually every restaurant and bar is its own experience now. It's not just a place that you sit down and kind of quite functionally have some drinks and spend time with friends.
Yes.
Actually, everywhere is trying to be immersive and a really kind of artistic place to be. So if you're kind of getting that hit, let's say, from lots of other places, then again, a concert needs to be something really special and something really worth it to warrant doing that over other things.
How? All right. First, I want to ask you about the effect of Spotify, of Netflix, as you said. The concerts, they're there. They're streaming. They hear them on the tube. They hear them on the train. They hear them in the car. Maybe when they go home, they don't want to hear anything else. They want quiet.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think classical music has a really complex relationship with Spotify and music streaming services. It's not something that we know an awful lot about, actually. And I've just done a big survey, which we'll be publishing at some point in the next year or so, trying to look at the relationship between streaming, listening on streaming services and concerts, because we just know so little.
Yes.
I think it cuts both ways. And on the one hand, music is everywhere. And so, yeah, do you just want a bit of quiet? Are you a bit oversaturated? On the other hand, what we see is people really valuing live music as a place to listen in a really focused way.
Mm.
Whereas when you're at home, when you're on the move, it's such a kind of distracted way of listening.
Yes.
That
it's more background, really.
Yeah. Mm. And that can be wonderful. Like, that's no bad thing. But it's only in having music in those forms that then live music offers something different.
No, please finish.
And I think that there's a lot that we can do to really promote what it is that live music gives you that recording doesn't. So things like the social experience, the atmosphere, the focus, the live sound, the kind of uncompressed sound, those are things that we actually should be shouting about quite a lot.
You spoke about experience, and you've explained, you know, somewhat now with the social experience and being immersed. What approach do you think orchestras should be taking, and maybe broadcasters in a different way? What approach should they be taking in order to make that an immersive experience? How much of that is really necessary, and what can you do? A concerto is a concerto. So you go to hear a fabulous soloist playing, you hear the overture, you hear a symphony. What else is needed? Is it all about multimedia all the time?
I think it's not about anything all the time. I think what we need to try and get towards within concerts is just a much greater variety of what we have on offer. And I really advocate for, where it's possible, thinking about... So we quite often think about programming when it comes to a big orchestra as so much is kind of taken as given. You know, like I said, it will start at 7:30 in the UK. That is the absolute, you know, the time that most concerts start.
Yes.
It will start at 7:30. It will be about 2.5 hours. it will be these musicians, it will be in the hall, it will be, the audience will be quiet, you know, all these things. And then the things that get kind of changed out are just the pieces and the soloists. And actually, we should think really carefully about all of those parts of that experience. And there are some pieces that might not shine in a concert hall. They might be better in other kinds of venues, or some pieces that work really well in maybe slightly noisier environments where audiences can kind of talk to each other. I also think things like presenters, having people on stage that actually greet and welcome the audience and talk about what they're going to hear.
As opposed to having a program, for example.
Yeah,
so not have a printed program, but actually have someone introducing the pieces.
I think you can also do both. It can be one or both, but certainly all of the research shows that newcomers really appreciate having someone on the stage, and actually can find it quite rude that if there is no one speaking from the stage, that the musicians kind of shuffle on and then we clap one of them. And then they don't really acknowledge the audience until they bow and leave. And that, if you're thinking about kind of pop and rock performances maybe being a slightly more familiar place to lots of audiences, that feels quite strange and actually at times quite rude. So I think having someone there, thinking about how you welcome in audiences, how you acknowledge their presence, how you engage them on a kind of human level is a really important factor.
How do you manage that possible newcomer, or I would say younger person, in comparison with the tried and trusted, say 50 plus, who knows what's coming, who's going out for an evening of I don't know, submersion into the music, who's familiar with the symphony that they're going to hear, who probably has read up and actively sought out the soloist. How would an orchestra make that approach? Or would you advertise it as maybe two different events, two different evenings?
I think this is kind of the eternal question. In really all kinds of art marketing, how do you satisfy your existing audience while still building new audiences? I do think there are certain things that don't seem to alienate existing audiences, and I would say presenters are one of them, because audiences across the board really like that human connection, that human touch.
Yes.
The sense of not just this piece is amazing, but I love this piece for these reasons. So I think that one is a kind of easy win across the board. There are then other things that are slightly more complicated when you particularly start looking at the kind of rules we have around audience behavior and the extent to which, you know, people can talk or are, you know, encouraged to be silent. And those are things that I don't necessarily have an answer to, because I think it's a case-by-case basis. But I think often if organizations are serious about connecting with new audiences, then one of the most important things I think they can do is to try and take some of their work out of the concert hall, because in those other kinds of spaces, it just tends to not have the same sense of strict rules around, again, around kind of silence that concert halls have.
You're very right. I remember doing symphony concerts in that with the National Symphony Orchestra, and every Mother's Day we did a concert at the zoo. And
oh, fantastic.
Yes, and it was a great success. People, you know, either brought their lunches or they could have lunch there. They walked around the zoo, they heard the concert, the classical pieces, but shorter, popular, understood pieces, and it was incredibly successful. It's still going on.
And what's so lovely about that as well is that I can hear the kind of joy or excitement in your voice, because, you know, I think as much as it can be really it can be annoying as musicians to kind of have to keep going back to those familiar pieces, when you get a concert where you can really see and feel and hear how much the audience loved it.
Yes.
Those pieces do come back to life.
Yes.
And it's not about, yeah, kind of dumbing down or selling out. It's about meeting audiences where they're at and not expecting that everyone will enjoy sitting for, you know, an hour and 10 minutes and listening to a big Bruckner symphony.
Yes.
That's not going to be for everyone.
No.
But there are bits of classical music that probably can be for a lot of people. It's just about finding that common ground.
Well, I must, I mean, if we look at Nessun Dorma, for example, before Pavarotti actually sang it with the three tenors, I wonder how many people actually knew the aria Nessun Dorma. If we look at radio broadcasting and looking at our audiences, what do you say should be the beginning of how a broadcaster can actually start to make this very important research? And is it something that costs a phenomenal amount of money? Because it's always, money is the source of saying, well, we can't do this.
I think that doing enormous research projects is always going to take money, because it's always going to take people's time and people need to be paid. So there's, you know, huge projects can be expensive, but I think there are always really low cost, light touch ways of just starting those conversations with audiences.
Mm.
Whether it is thinking about how social media is being used, how can you encourage more of a conversation there, or how can you encourage audiences to kind of get in touch and share what they're doing or what it is that they love about certain programs. Even that is just starting to get a dialogue. And things like, doing a small number of interviews or a quick focus group can still be quite accessible, quite kind of low barriers to entry in terms of the amount of money that you need. Even if you kind of got six people in to form a focus group and and gave them each a voucher and then quickly wrote a report afterwards that said these are the main points that came up, that's maybe a couple of days work and the cost of a few vouchers. So it doesn't need to be everything all at once. It can be light touch if that is all that anyone has got the capacity to do. And I would say, like, it's just something is better than nothing always when it comes to understanding audiences.
Food for thought. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Sarah Price. It's been wonderful to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Saskia. Thanks for inviting me.